You're with us on The Morning Show as we broadcast from our studios in Superior. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're looking at conservation in the Great Lakes region and the policy efforts underway to promote restoration. And you can join in. We're at 800-642-1234. Do you live on the Great Lakes? And if so, what do you love about it? And what are the challenges? Jen Venater is a policy analyst and the Great Lakes Program Coordinator at the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission. Jen, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, introduce us to the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission. What are you tackling? What is your work like?
Well, first, the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission is an intertribal natural resource agency. We have delegated authority to co-manage natural resources within what we call the ceded territories. And these territories cover much of the top third of the states of Michigan, Minnesota, and Wisconsin. While our primary job is to ensure compliance with federal court orders that recognize the continuing existence of our member tribes' hunting, fishing, and gathering rights, it is recognized that those rights are meaningless if the natural resources at their base are too contaminated to eat, or if the habitats in which they exist are degraded to the point at which their populations are not sustainable. So Glyphwick's mission has expanded to include managing for the health and sustainability of these natural resources, and that includes Lake Superior and its ecosystems as well.
So your commission is really involved in lots of different activities to protect natural resources while also incorporating an Ojibwe perspective into its work. You know, from the organization's perspective, what does that mean?
What that means is... So the indigenous perspective, while every community has its own underlying values, to state it in a simple way, we emphasize the importance of learning from the other beings in natural communities, recognizing there's an interdependence between all beings, including the inanimate and animate objects. And this means that humans have a certain responsibility towards the natural world. The natural world can exist without humans, whereas humans are dependent on that natural world. So we tend to take a management perspective that supports what is in the best interest of those natural resources, while, the modern management technique is more focused on maybe what is best for humans. What this translates into is we tend to skew management efforts more towards a protective framework.
And here we are, we're broadcasting from Superior and feeling very close to Lake Superior. And when it comes to conservation and environmental protection, the commission is focused on the Great Lakes. What does that entail? What are you doing?
Well, the work that we're doing is twofold. One is an overarching management work. So my job is essentially to help coordinate the exercise of tribal sovereignty with the other governments that have a role in Great Lakes management. And this involves ensuring that tribes have a seat at the table whenever decisions are being made, and trying to ensure those decisions reflect the Ojibwe management perspective. That translates to on-the-ground work with cooperative terrestrial invasive species monitoring, treatment, and control, aquatic invasive species control work. We are undertaking climate change vulnerability assessment on key species that are of importance to our member tribes, and climate adaptation planning. We're doing water quality monitoring work. We are monitoring for legacy and emerging chemicals in the water of the Great Lakes and its tributaries. And we're also working on the restoration of important areas within the lake that have already been degraded, such as Buffalo Reef off the Keweenaw Peninsula in Michigan.
We're talking with Jen Venater. She's a policy analyst and the Great Lakes Program Coordinator at the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission. You can join in with your thoughts, your perspectives, questions, 800-642-1234. Perhaps you live on the Great Lakes. And if so, what do you appreciate about the conservation, about restoration efforts, and what are the challenges that you see? You can join in at 800-642-1234, email ideas@wpr.org. So, you know, the Great Lakes, they're the Midwest's greatest shared resource. And as a result, there's a lot of people, a lot of stakeholders here. You've got the local governments and the state governments, the tribes. So how does the commission fit in here and work with all of these different agencies and these different interests?
Well, like you said, the Great Lakes are an international, they're international bodies of water, and so they're governed by numerous international and regional agreements, treaties, and various management bodies. So the commission, along with the Great Lakes tribes, sit on the management bodies with the other governments. So we can start with the Great Lakes Water Quality Agreement, which is the primary agreement between the United States and Canada that makes commitments with regards to the quality of water in the Great Lakes. So the primary body that oversees the Great Lakes, that oversees the implementation of the agreement, is the Great Lakes Executive Committee, which is made up of representatives from federal agencies from Canada and the U.S. and state agencies around the basin and the agencies from Ontario and tribes. And GLIF Lakes sits on that body. And it narrows all the way down to the Lake Superior Partnership, which is a partnership that implements the Lake Superior Lakewide Action Management Plan, which makes specific commitments from all the agencies from all the various jurisdictions around Lake Superior. And it makes commitments working towards the priorities on conservation and restoration around.
Do you find that communication lines are pretty strong and open, that people are working together?
In Lake Superior, it is very much an open and engaged process. We all work very well together, and there's a long history of cooperation.
Where do you see that most? Where do you see that cooperation shining through in the best interest of Lake Superior?
Well, I mean, it's on an individual staff level between mm-hmm. all the various agencies, but also when you get to the Lake Superior Partnership. You know, we have weekly teleconferences where we touch base with where we are on reaching the priorities in the Lakewide Action and Management Plan. And it travels from that level all the way up to the broader Great Lakes Basin.
And what about the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative? You know, how is that initiative making an impact?
The Great Lakes Restoration Initiative has been a wonderful initiative. It has provided, for tribes specifically, it has provided the capacity to become much more engaged and active in all of these management bodies. It has allowed for staff and travel and capacity to participate in these.
And what kind of lake management work is being done?
Under the GLRI?
Under the Restoration Initiative.
Under the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative, so for tribes, we have, there's a lot of capacity funding, like I said, to allow tribes to have the capacity to attend these meetings and have somebody to work on these initiatives full-time. And GLIF Lake itself receives GLRI funding to work on its terrestrial invasive species and its aquatic invasive species work. And we're doing lake whitefish and lake trout depth, temperature, and diet studies to determine why some populations seem to be in decline.
We're talking with Jen Venater. She's a policy analyst and Great Lakes Program Coordinator at the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission. Are you worried about conservation on the lakes or other environmental issues? If so, what is on your mind? We're at 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a minute here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and we're talking about conservation live from Superior, Wisconsin. Eight states have shoreline on the Great Lakes, and stakeholders are working across government and cultural lines to preserve and protect these natural resources. Are you concerned about conservation on the lakes or other environmental issues? What is on your mind? What questions do you have about the role of the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission? We're at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Or with Jen Van Otter. She's a policy analyst and the Great Lakes Program Coordinator at the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission. Jen, one of the biggest challenges in conservation work right now and in the future is how to deal with the consequences of climate change. And when it comes to the Great Lakes, where are we seeing that impact?
Well, we're seeing one of the most obvious are more frequent precipitation events, flooding where we've never had flooding before, flooding that's happening more often. We're also seeing warmer winters, which has less snow cover, which impacts specifically for Cliff Lake, it impacts culturally important species like sugar maple and martens. We're also seeing it in the possible decline of wild rice. And
what work is being done to mitigate that impact? Where are you making inroads there?
Well, the work that we're doing right now, we are undertaking a vulnerability assessment study of 60 species of importance to our tribes, and we are trying to determine their ranking in terms of vulnerability with regard to various climate change scenarios. And we're also undertaking a phenology study to try to fill in some gaps as to what changes we're going to be seeing in various species. And that will lead to climate adaptation planning at this point.
And certainly with these efforts, fish are impacted, and the Great Lakes section of the Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission works to ensure treaty reserved fishing rights are preserved. What does that look like in practice?
So we undertake annual fish abundance studies on white fish and lake trout. And we're also right now undertaking a diet and diet diversity study for lake whitefish. We've seen some recent declines in fish growth size and condition in the lake. And so we're undertaking this diet study and depth temperature study to try to understand what might be causing this, whether it could be something like climate change or there not being enough food or changes to the dry cygnid mussel populations in the lake.
Do you see that the efforts to combat climate change and the work that the commission is doing, will that impact fishing on the Great Lakes?
There is that potential, yes.
And one of the more recent projects that you've worked on has to do with water diversion. What can you tell us about that?
Well, as you know, the regional body and the Compact Council have a process for applying for diverting water out of the Great Lakes Basin. Last year, they undertook a review of this process to see if changes needed to be made. Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission helped to facilitate the involvement of tribes and First Nations in this review process to make sure we could help help any changes that needed to be made in that process. And this year, the Compact Council and regional body are undertaking a review of their science strategy and possible changes to their cumulative impact analysis for analyzing how water diversions, consumptive uses, and can cumulatively impact the water quality or quantity in the Great Lakes Basin. And we are participating in that review as well.
So cumulative impact study means looking at all of the ways that that water is being impacted and then figuring out a way to move forward?
Right. As each of these applications for diversions are presented, they're analyzed not only on how they would impact that specific region, but how each diversion that currently exists would possibly add together to have a greater impact. And so they're undertaking a review to see if the way in which they analyze those cumulative impacts can be improved.
In recent years, the city of Waukesha has sought approval to divert water from Lake Michigan in an effort to replace the city's contaminated drinking water. How did that situation factor in here?
That situation spurred the decision on the part of the Compact Council and regional body to undertake a review of their process, and specifically to see if there were changes that needed to be made for objections to any diversion application decisions.
And as you look forward for the commission, what are other issues that you're working on in the coming months that are on your plate and you're really trying to dig into?
Well, what we're working on right now, we have Action Plan 3 coming up for the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative. That is a five-year action plan that kind of directs funding decisions under the GLRI. That is currently under review. The GLRI has developed a new tribal-specific program that we are trying to help direct the development of that to a degree that is most helpful for reaching the goals of the GLRI and continued implementation of the Great Lakes Water Quality Agreement and a drafting of a new lake-wide action and management plan for Lake Superior.
As we wrap up here, we had heard earlier this month President Trump expressing his support for the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative, and he's now calling for full funding after his budget originally called for cuts to the program. What do you see happening here in terms of funding?
I am highly optimistic that it will be fully funded again. There is, great relationships and cooperation amongst all stakeholders within the Great Lakes region as to the importance of the GLRI and the importance of continuing the work that we've been doing on the restoration and protection of the Great Lakes.
Well, Jen, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Jen Venater is a policy analyst and the Great Lakes Program Coordinator at the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission. Invasive species control is one piece of conservation, and today our highlight is on the sea lamprey.
They're a parasite, so they actually can rasp through their skin, then they suck out their body fluids, and that's how they feed. And obviously that's not good for the fish.
Not good at all. Our search for more about sea lamprey is in the Great Lakes led our team to Middle River in northern Wisconsin. The morning show's executive producer, Keely Baltina, has this story.
In late April, it takes a snow shovel, dodging branches, scraping pickup truck windows, and dragging fallen limbs off a path to make it to the river.
We've never found any lamprey above it since it's been constructed.
Cloudy water topples over the edge of a dam. It crashes into white waves below. Fish biologist Sean Lewandowski says the barrier stops sea lampreys. The fish looks like an eel, gray and slim. It has a disc for a mouth with teeth. They're not pretty.
They don't have that going for them either. But they are interesting fish. They're neat.
All throughout the Great Lakes, agencies work together to control the population of this menace. Bill Mattis is with the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission.
They attacked the lake trout primarily because it's a soft-sided, it has real small scales, so it's easy for the lamprey to attack. It will attack any fish. It'll attack lake sturgeon that have plates on the side of them.
Mattis says the sea lamprey population peaked in the 1960s. The numbers today, though, are down 90% from that historic high.
And the reason there's such a collaboration to control the sea lamprey is that without the sea lamprey being controlled to the point where they are now at 10%, we would not have lake trout fisheries, likely wouldn't have whitefish fisheries, and would have less of the nearshore fisheries because the lamprey would feed on the fish.
U.S. Fish and Wildlife officials are scouting Middle River. Fish biologist Sean Lewandowski is preparing to set metal traps again this spring to catch lampreys.
It's basically just like a rectangle, and it has two funnels that fish can swim into, and they can't swim out. So we just set them right up against the dam, and lamprey moving upstream looking to find their way over the dam will end up just swimming into the funnels, and that's how we catch them.
Removing adult lampreys prevents them from spawning, which means the next generation of lampreys can't destroy fish native to the Great Lakes. Lewandowski says it's an unending battle.
The goal of actually 100% getting rid of all of them is not very feasible in the near future.
If nothing else, sea lampreys invading Lake Superior offer some job security.
I'm pretty confident in my lifetime. I'm set. Who knows what they'll figure out 30 years from now. But.
The Morning Show's Keely Boltina and Laura Pavin produced this story in northern Douglas County. And we continue this broadcast from our studios in Superior with a focus on forest conservation. Learn how state officials and private landowners are partnering to promote sustainability. That's up next, right after this news update. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network. It's the Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, broadcasting live from our studios in Superior. The Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources is connecting with private landowners all over the state to promote sustainable forestry and land management practices. And the hope is to reach thousands more landowners in the coming years. Do you own forested land in the state? And if so, would you be open to working with the State Department of Natural Resources on a management plan? Join in at 800-642-1234. Diane Gunderson is a private forestry outreach specialist at the Wisconsin DNR. Diane, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good morning.
And Terry Oslison is with us as well, a forester with the DNR. She's the supervisor for the Brule Team of Integrated Foresters. Terry, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Good morning.
Well, Diane, let's start with you. Why is it important to reach out and connect with landowners here in Wisconsin on this issue of sustainable land management and forestry?
Well, the majority of Wisconsin woodlands are privately owned. So that's about 9.8 million of Wisconsin's 17 million acres of forested land are all held by private landowners.
So, Diane, as you work with these landowners, what is the first step in reaching out with them and connecting with them?
Well, generally, we recommend that they start with a walk on their property with a forester, and that's a free service that the DNR provides to every landowner, preferably with 10 or more acres.
Terry, what do you see as the benefits of privately owned forests?
Well, since there's so many forests across the state, it's a way to create sustainable forestry to more acres and get people engaged and understanding. Really, the process is education. And if we can educate people about what they have and gauge their interest, that's really the fun part of figuring out why people own the land and are excited about it, whatever makes them tick or stay engaged. So it's important they can contribute to a habitat on their own, recreation on their own, and then when you put it across the state, it just creates healthy forest. And
so what you're saying is all of these pieces of land have a backstory. They have a story, and these private landowners are able to kind of tell you that story and how and what practices came to be on that land?
That is true. Yep, that's correct.
And you're encouraging sustainable forestry. As a forester, how would you define that concept?
So essentially it's a form of proactive management that you can it's balancing what you have today, well, starting past today and then for future generations. So your wildlife habitat, water, basically everything's integrated, and we want to have what we have now and make it present or available for future generations.
And Diane, the DNR is wanting to reach 20,000 landowners in the next 5 years to try and develop a conservation plan for an additional 1 million acres of forest in the state. So how are you going to get that goal accomplished?
Well, we have a couple of initiatives from a statewide level, and we also are working with the foresters to provide them with the resources they need to work directly with the landowners successfully, as Terry mentioned.
How are those relationships like, and how do you establish trust?
Well, we've built some strong relationships with some key partners that have like-minded goals like we do as far as protecting our natural resources on a statewide level. And some of those folks are from the American Forest Foundation, which is a national program, and using their Woods Camp technology tool. Another one of our key partners is the Aldo Leopold Foundation, and their My Wisconsin Woods, or actually I should say our My Wisconsin Woods program, and also the University of Extension, University Stevens Point, and the Wisconsin Woodlands Owner Association are some of the top partners that we've built relationships over the past, 10 years or more. And they, like I said, they have like-minded goals and have developed that trust both ways with each other.
Do you find, Diane, that there, as you have like-minded goals, are there similar plans for forestry management that are being incorporated across the state? Or are there plans that perhaps are somewhat divergent?
They're very synergistic. We are actually even working on work together on a statewide outreach coalition so that we are maximizing our opportunities and our efforts in both presenting materials. When we work with the landowner, it's a cohesive process where we're all integrated and can provide resources at different phases of where the landowner's at in their decision-making process.
We're talking with Diane Gunderson, a private forestry outreach specialist at the Wisconsin DNR, and Terry Oslison is a forester with the Wisconsin DNR. You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Have you worked with the DNR to help manage your own land? And if so, how did it go? How did it come about? What was the result? And what questions do you have about sustainable forestry here in Wisconsin? We're at 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Gary now, calling from Boscoville. Hi, Gary.
Thank you for taking my call. I'd like to push back on some of the forestry techniques that are being employed on these private property and working with private landowners. I've been doing prairie restoration and oak savanna restoration for 45 years. And one of our main tools in that process is using prescribed burns. And every year, especially the fire control people and the forestry people are getting more and more obsessive and compulsive about using fire as a management tool. Fire in Wisconsin impacted every single native plant community that we had here in pre-settlement times. And without fire on some of these plant communities in Wisconsin, they tend to degrade rapidly. And in oak forest, the oak reproduction is degraded by the lack of fire. And we use fire as a critically important for maintaining or eliminating invasive species in our woodlands. And so for the DNR, I worked for the DNR for 35 years, and for the fire control people in DNR, they are counterproductive to doing any kind, that those policies are counterproductive to doing any kind of sensible and meaningful forestry management.
Gary, I want to pause right there and bring up a number of points. Terry Oslison, you're a forester. What do you see there in terms of prescribed burns?
Well, correct. He is correct. Fire is an excellent tool as far as silviculture goes for regenerating oak. We do use it as a tool in the toolbox, but because the conditions are, you need specific conditions in order to burn on specific days and sites. So it isn't probably often used, but it is there an option. And he is correct. There are habitats throughout the state that depend on fire. Now, I'm not saying, I mean, he could call locally and talk to people about that, but there are actions being done across the state to promote habitats for those specific places, oak savannas, barrens. I know barrens up here in the northwest part of the state is a huge, the rolling barrens concept is a big thing right now in providing habitat for basically barrens type species, like example, the sharp-tailed grouse and stuff like that.
Yeah. Terry, do you see prescribed burns happening on private landowner property in forested areas?
It can be, but the fire control does kind of offer permits and inspect. So it can be done. They just like to have people do it safely. That's the main concern, that it's done safely to protect the resource and the people.
So, Diane, when you meet with private landowners and do that walk on their property, what are some of the questions you ask? What comes up in those conversations?
Well, Terry might be better positioned as she works directly with the landowners themselves. But from what we know, a lot of the landowners like to understand what they have on their property. They often, and we're talking more of the landowners that aren't working with somebody right now. They may not even have worked with anyone about their property, or maybe they aren't even sure what to do next. And so we like to work with them to identify trees, invasive species on their properties, work with them on what they want to do with their property, how long have they had the properties, what do they want to do with it, both now and in the long term. A lot of folks are interested in wildlife habitat and how they can create a habitat for increasing the wildlife on their property, or bird watching, or maybe hunting, maybe recreation. So we are trying to work with them to understand what it is that they want to do and help them get to their goals on their property over time.
We're looking at the impact of private landowners on state forest land. Diane Gunderson is our guide. She is a private forestry outreach specialist at the Wisconsin DNR. And Terry Oselson is a forester with the DNR. You can join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. Have you previously worked with the DNR to help manage your land? And if so, how did it come about? What was the result? What questions do you have about sustainable forestry? Call in. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. We'll be back in just a minute right here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Wisconsin's forests cover nearly half of the state, and private landowners hold the largest chunk of these woodlands, more than 10 million acres. The DNR hopes to reach thousands of these landowners to help them do better at forest management. Do you own your own forested land in the state? And if so, would you be open to working with the State Department of Natural Resources on a management plan? Join in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Diane Gunderson is a private forestry outreach specialist at the DNR, and she stays with us. Terry Oselson is here as well, a forester with the DNR. She's the supervisor for the Brule team of integrated foresters. We heard from Michael, who called in to ask what the plan for the land is. He's a landowner and might be interested in a program like this. What will be done with the land, he asks? Does it coexist with natural conservation goals? Terry, would you like to take that?
Sure. So really, it depends on what he has goals for his property. So my job is not to tell him what to do, but to figure out what he wants to do. So Diane alluded to basically having conversations with these landowners, and really it comes down to finding out the who, what, when, where, you know, that sort of thing. So you're just asking a list of questions to figure out where their background is coming from, why they have the property, and then tying that all together. So you want this, now how do we get there? And maybe that's through active management. Maybe it's through a little just if he has an invasive or something. So we can treat that or write goals. So he has his goals that we put down, and so we're listening to that landowner, and then we're just trying to make that all happen, working together. And, you know, it's really a cooperation or a partnership between the landowner and the state. And then at some point it's up to the landowner. We can help them guide, you know, and push to the right resources that are out there, like different funding sources, if that's the case. But we just help guide the landowner to where they need to be to get to their goal.
Do you often find landowners in that active management, they're harvesting those forests and getting a paycheck in return every once in a while?
That is correct. I mean, as a forester, I have to say, I do like to see wood go to market, but that's not the end goal for everyone. And mm-hmm. it might be just actually tertiary. Maybe wildlife habitat is their ultimate goal, but in getting there, we could suggest, well, maybe if you harvest this, you'll create more browse and get more sunlight entering the forest floor that creates that herbaceous layer and young forest seedling saplings to promote different species of wildlife, for example.
Let's go to Karen now, joining us from Hollandale. Good morning, Karen.
Good morning. Your show is really interesting this morning. Thanks.
Great.
We sort of naively bought about 80 acres of land in the Driftless area, and 20 acres are in a USDA forestry plantation program. And we thought we were buying this great asset, and now we've been told the pine trees are mature, it's time to cut them, but there's no market for it. And in between the pines, they planted rows of oak trees, which never caught on, and ash trees, which are now all dead or dying. Our beautifully forested asset land seems like a liability. What do we do now?
Karen, thanks for the call. Terry, what do you hear there?
So that was actually quite common where you would plant either for just watershed protection or, you know, kind of to prevent soil erosion and stuff in those hilly countries of the southwest part of the state. And it was suggested to plant oak between the pine or a hardwood type species for just a variation. When the pine grew, you could cut that and release your oak. But likely deer browse limited the oak growth. So what you have is the pine left. And perhaps they are mature where you would do a thinning, and you can wait for the markets to turn around. They usually do. But with the ash, that is true. There's EAB on the generally prolific down there, or it's spreading, you know. So I would say you could plant more pine. I mean, and just, you know, wait. I mean, forests are a long-term.
Wait it out a bit.
Yeah. It's a long-term thing. I mean, they're not going to
turn overnight.
Yeah.
Let's go to John in Boaz. John, hi. Hey, John, are you there? Nope, I think we've lost John. Diane, I understand you've got a few different initiatives rolling out between now and early July. Can you walk us through those?
Sure can. We're, like I mentioned earlier, we're working with the American Forest Foundation, and they have a tool called Woods Camp, which is a technology tool. And we look at doing, they manage that through Facebook ads or social media. So that's a great way to target landowners and link them up with resources to, you know, do what they landowners want to do on their property. We're also working with Aldo Leopold Foundation and created a landowner portal, if you will, at mywisconsinwoods.org, where landowners can go there to request a free forester visit, look at other free resources that are available, and also get connected with fellow landowners if they want to talk to landowner peers and whatnot, if that's the way they want to go. We want to make sure we're offering enough resources for landowners, so if they're comfortable working in this direction or with these people, or maybe they're more comfortable working in a different direction with some different folks. So I just want to make a lot of options available to make it easy for the landowner. We'll also be out there. You'll starting to see some media out there statewide. Both of those initiatives, the MyWisconsinWoods.org and the Woods Camp, are starting rolling out. We've been piloting Woods Camp for about the last year in the Lake Superior Basin area and the Driftless area. And we're filling the gap on the western part of the state, and starting right now. And by July 1st, we'll be statewide with both Woods Camp. And right now, MyWisconsinWoods.org is a statewide effort. And like I said, you'll be seeing some media out there this spring and into early summer.
And I want to jump bring awareness. I want to jump in here because I think John in Boaz has a quick point to make. John, hi.
Hi, good morning. Burning trees is carbon neutral. If we would harvest our trees, such as shagbark hickory, in our 17 million acres, we could replace oil, gas, and coal.
Terry, what do you make of that?
Well, so the wood resource that is out on the land is an excellent sustainable resource, and as long as we're not, I mean, the plan is to use it, it is sustainable, but as long as we're not over harvesting. So, I mean, it's an option and people can consider it. I think there's technologies out there, but I'm not to say that everybody will go that route. It's kind of economically driven too. So there's a lot behind it, but it is a good renewable resource for our
Before we have to let you go, I want to ask, tomorrow is Arbor Day. It's also about planting and caring for trees. What is the best way to celebrate, Terry?
Well, I would definitely say plant a tree. Get a tree from the state nursery. That's always a good way to go. Or several trees. Reforest your property. Or afforest your property. Plant some trees in a new location. Also, just being a good steward of the land is an excellent way, where we all have our own goals. So to just be good stewards and promote for future generations is great.
Well, thank you both for joining us. Diane Gunderson is a private forestry outreach specialist at the Wisconsin DNR. Terry Osselson there, a forester with the DNR. She's also the supervisor for the Brule team of integrated foresters. You're listening to The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is the Ideas Network.